History itself is a kind of haunting. In its most abstract, it's a chorus of non-present presences that tell us something, that enfold us at all times and everywhere. These resonances of the past, sometimes they're unseen, and yet they're real. I live in Fayette County, West Virginia, and for years now I've been visiting a place called the Whipple Company Store, a place where stories hover and swirl. It was built at the turn of the 20th century by Justice Collins, a notoriously despicable coal operator. And it's an odd design, an octagon stacked on top of a hexagon with pointy gables that jut up into the sky. To reach the entrance, you walk up a steep set of stairs and through a wide arch to a dark covered porch. From below, it looks like a giant gaping mouth. And when you look at that mouth and those darkened windows, sometimes you can't help but feel like something is looking back. But at one time, this place was very much alive. The community not only did their shopping there, they also visited the doctor, got their mail, paid their telephone bill. Today, it's run as a museum to life in the coal camps, attracting hundreds of visitors a year, some from far away, and others who grew up next door, like Cora Sue Barrett.
My Aunt Elsie lived up here. This is the old church.
She and others like her come to the store to listen and learn, but they also leave their own imprint behind.
When I came in, it was just like, oh, I remember. Mm-hmm. I remember. I mean, it seems like it starts working inward, and it just has to come out.
What happens normally is people don't come in here to tell you anything.
That's Joy Lynn, co-owner of the museum.
As we continue to tour the building, they start reliving their memories. So they let go a lot of their own history. And after 3 to 4 stories sort of overlap, then we usually share them on tours.
She not only runs history tours out of the store, she lets paranormal investigators from all over come and conduct research.
Jane is the psychic of the group, and I run the technical end.
That's Bonnie Hughes. She and her partner, Jane Skeldon, have spent entire nights at the store trying to speak back to the spirits they say inhabit its rooms. One night, I meet these women at the store, along with a man named Wes Harris, a frequent visitor.
I can't keep away from it.
And strong promoter of the stories that are told there.
And every time I let the word out of what I'm seeing here, it's having a huge impact on people, not just intellectually, but emotionally. And so we're just having this incredible surge of energy of people wanting to get in this building.
It's dark. It's late autumn. Chilly. We gather in the main downstairs room of the store, a vast, circular space where the slightest whisper echoes. Joy tells a story about how company spies would stand at a central display counter to listen for signs of union organizing.
Would stand there and listen.
She then points out an enormous, creaky freight elevator that accessed a so-called secret second floor, where she says coffins for miners were stored. A self-described debunker of ghost stories, Joy nevertheless avoids the store's basement.
I don't do the basement.
Where she says the company prepared their workers' bodies for the grave in an in-house embalming studio. We move to a narrow hallway towards the rear of the building, where I stare up at an open door near the ceiling. Wes explains that this was a guarded safe where the coal company stored its cash. It's been one of Bonnie and Jane's hotspots. One night, they were mounting a camera there, and Bonnie asked Jane to hand her a stepladder.
And she goes, no, I can't, because there's a dead guy laying in the hallway.
It seemed like it was a movie that was being reenacted. He said, you can see me. And he said, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And he got shot right through that door and hit the wall, and so the blood just splattered everywhere.
People shuffle nervously. But then we move on to yet another safe, and as we crowd into the tiny metal room,
I smell coal dust.
Cora Sue suddenly smells coal dust.
Are you okay?
And fills with emotion.
Man, I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know. I could smell. Like a man comes out of the mines, mm-hmm. and he has the coal dust on his clothes. Mm-hmm. It just rose up.
Bonnie and Jane play us whispery voices, not their own, they say, that they've recorded in the safe.
Can you give us a sign if you're here?
But despite the talk of unexplained phenomena, I'm not really creeped out at this point. It's the next story, that feels like the first true horror we've encountered. Inside the safe, several small slips of paper stamped with numbers are displayed. According to Joy, these tickets are what's known as Esau scrip. The story of Esau, she says, was shared with her by the store's bookkeeper. Wes tells the story of Esau as it was told to him.
Esau was a special kind of scrip, sometimes called super scrip, as in you got it from the superintendent, issued only to women, and it was a form of scrip that would enable a woman to purchase food for her children during the time that her husband couldn't work. But it was only good for 30 days. And if her husband went back to work within those 30 days, then the company, in their kindness, would forgive the debt. And if he did not go back to work at the end of 30 days, then the scrip became a loan that was due and payable in full on day 30. And, of course, the women didn't have jobs or scrip or money. And so they had to pay it back, and it was a collateralized loan. And the women themselves were the collateral.
What does that mean?
That means that their physical selves would be used to pay the debt. And you don't have to go too much further on the radio to fill in the blanks.
But not everyone thinks Esau is history, exactly. We'll pick back up tomorrow. For now, I'm Catherine Moore, reporting from Whipple, West Virginia.